This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
Welcome everyone to Redacted on this Tuesday evening. I'm Clayton Morris.
I'm Natalie Morris.
And wherever in the world you happen to be, all around the world, let us know in the chat. I love seeing where the furthest people are from us right now. We have people in Iceland, and I want to find an Antarctica person who's joining
us. I saw hello from Scotland. I saw hello from Texas. Hello back to you. We are Clayton and Natalie Morris. We come to you from Portugal. We are American expats, a married couple, and former mainstream media journalists, and we come to you on our own platform, happily so.
That's right. So on today's show, and our goal here on this show is to seek the truth, to follow the truth wherever it leads us. And we've got a jam-packed show for you on this Tuesday night. So we're going to talk about the latest in the war in Ukraine. We're going to be joined by some special guests on the show today who we've had some time to interview today as well. We're going to be diving deeply into what is the very latest and the strategy going forward during the war, for the war in Ukraine. Where will Russia go next? What will NATO do next? And that is going to be a very big question, because this seems like a perfect opportunity right now, actually, to call for peace and for these world leaders to say, okay, enough is enough. Let's call for peace. So we'll see what the very latest is there.
Plus, we are going to continue to break down the plot around the bridge in Crimea that was attacked. We have some theories about that.
Some
confirmations, yeah, actually, of said theories. We're going to look at Bosnia as well, because there's a recount of the presidential election happening there. And these are clear battle lines between alliances with NATO and alliances with Russia. And we're going to ask many questions.
Also, the Dutch farmers, last night, one of our viewers said, hey, I'd love to hear a follow-up on that story, because it has become a desperate situation for these farmers. And absolutely. And so we're going to be joined today by Ralph Schulhammer, who has been following the story very, very closely. I sat down with him a little earlier today in Austria to have a deeper discussion about what is actually happening right now with these Dutch farmers who are losing their land. But it's not just happening in the Netherlands. It's also happening in Germany. And it's now spread to New Zealand as well. So the World Economic Forum clamping down on these farmers and what it means for our food supply going forward. All of that and more as Redacted starts right now. Welcome into Redacted on this Tuesday evening. So great to have all of you here. And I should remind you, if you're watching us the replay a little bit later, we have a 30-minute countdown, because we do a live show every day at 4 p.m. Eastern time. So we are live 4 p.m. Eastern time every day. And we put a 30-minute countdown timer, because it takes YouTube its sweet time to send out alerts and Rumble as well. And we'd like to gather up an audience. So last night after the show, I was watching comments from people who are watching the replay of the show. And they're like, because they're not in our chat, and they were watching the replay, and they're like, God, this countdown is so long. Why do you put a countdown here? It's like, well, we don't do that just on a recorded video that we publish to you. It's a live show. It just takes us a while. It takes YouTube a long time to edit that 30 minutes off the start of the show. Just so you understand.
So then tomorrow, you don't have to watch that unless it's 4 p.m. Eastern, then we're rolling that live.
But I'd also like to point out to people that, because I see people in the chat saying we should put timestamps. But the reason that doesn't work is because we do afterwards edit off the countdown timer, and it takes YouTube anywhere from, like, you know, however long it takes YouTube to apply that, all of our timestamps would be off. And so by the time everything lined up, it would be past the time. We would already have another show up.
Yes, exactly.
So that's
all
why
right,
we
so
don't
that's
do that.
The explanation.
Okay, so, and we have four segments per show usually. We should cover four big stories, plus we take your super chats. So, yes, that is the long and short of it. I'm glad we got out that stuff out of the way. I should mention, we do have a daily newsletter that's totally free. If you sign up for it by going to redacted.inc, you'll be delivered that in first thing in your morning inbox, right to your email. Where you can be informed over four to five big stories of the day. Natalie writes that newsletter. I don't know if you are aware of that. And it's delivered to your inbox first thing in the morning with some great content. She works really hard at it. And so if you notice any typos or errors, please direct them to her.
Oh, yes. For instance, today, I believe we called...
No. You.
I believe I wrote Balkan instead of Baltic. Or the other
Balkan,
way around.
Like Balkan. Balky from Bosom Buddies.
I'm really uncomfortable with accents. You can tell that I don't speak out loud very mm-hmm. often. I mostly just read, so forgive me. Yes, and so I apologize for those errors, and thank you for alerting us. Most people do that kindly, pointing out the mistakes, and it does not bother me.
All right, well, we want to start with our top story now, which is the war in Ukraine. And for the second straight day, Russia has been pounding strategic targets all across Ukraine. Now, most Ukrainians at this hour have no electricity. They have no running water. Four electrical substations out of service in Lviv, South Ukraine. Restoration is going to take months there, according to the city mayor. And that's the same situation all over Ukraine at this hour. This is in response to the terrorist attack on the Kerch Bridge in Crimea over the weekend. Russian officials from the Ministry of Defense said that all targets were neutralized yesterday, and that if other terrorist attacks were carried out, they would strike again. So what happened? Well, let's bring in Colonel Douglas McGregor. He's a former senior advisor to the Secretary of Defense in the United States. He's a renowned author on military strategy. He's one of the keenest intellects on the grand global chess game that we're now facing. He's also one of the few people actually telling the truth about this war. Colonel, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us here on Redacted.
Glad to be with you. Yeah.
Well, the Western media in particular, the Washington Post today, calling these strikes on Ukraine overnight and into this afternoon, a turning point in the war. And I couldn't help when I saw that wondering, I couldn't wait to ask you this question. You know, is that a rhetorical device designed to elicit some sort of emotional response that the tide is turning, the sea is changing now? Are we truly at a turning point? And if so, which way is this thing turning?
I think it's a turning point of sorts, perhaps not quite what the Washington Post is suggesting, which I think may be something else. But let's talk a little bit about this conflict, which has evolved considerably over the last 7 months. Conflicts are not static. War is an ever-changing sea, if you will. And for the last 7 months, even though people in the West will never, ever admit it, the truth is that President Putin has exercised enormous restraint with regard to the use of his military power. We've never seen more than 20% of the Russian ground force in Ukraine. And most of the regular Russian ground force was subsequently withdrawn after the first 4 months, during which the Ukrainian army that we built over several years was largely destroyed. What you have in Ukraine now is a mix of various volunteer organizations, militias, some allied forces like the Chechens, Kuban Cossack volunteer organizations. They've turned out to be very good fighters, plus the Wagner mercenary group. It's also turned out to be very effective on the ground. But the real Russian army, with its combat forces, has largely pulled out of the fight. I thought they would come back in August, but apparently the decision was made not to do that. And what's happened now, I think, in the Kremlin is that Mr. Putin and his advisors have all concluded there's no chance of negotiating an end to this conflict. I think he really clung to that hope, even in the middle of April, when it was clear that we in London would not permit Zelensky and Kyiv to make any sort of a compromise to accept neutrality, for instance, off the table. So now we're dealing with a different Russia. And what you saw yesterday in three waves were 202 missiles and loitering munitions attacking specific targets all over Ukraine. This is something that they've always been able to do. They have the precision-guided munitions and missiles, just as we do. This time, they not only hit so-called critical infrastructure, they also hit the secret police headquarters of the Ukrainian state, which is a notorious organization engaged in murdering people and forcing people into enemy gunfire at gunpoint, recruiting at gunpoint. But they also hit a number of analyst cells, places where people are putting together intelligence pictures. In other words, they've signaled that there's nothing happening in Western Ukraine that Moscow doesn't know about. And they've also signaled there's nothing over there they can't reach and destroy. So I think we're seeing a glimpse of what's going to happen later on this fall, which I predict will be major offensives on the ground once the soil freezes. That's coming. And this will be much closer to what a lot of us thought would happen at the very beginning. Massive offensives designed to utterly annihilate what remains of Ukrainian armed forces.
The Western media is trying to paint these Russian airstrikes, these attacks, as inconsequential. That they're not really hurting Ukraine. I've heard this from a few propaganda mainstream media outlets over the past 24 hours. And I'm just going through the laundry list of targets. I mean, hitting Polish forces that were amassed and ready to invade Russia proper, hitting NATO targets, hitting, as you mentioned, the SBU, hitting thermal power plants. There are people who are fleeing Ukraine in droves right now because they have no fresh water, they have no running water, they have no electricity, they have no internet. So the Western media says these attacks were inconsequential, Ukraine's fine. What do you say to that?
President Biden apparently felt compelled to call, or at least his handlers felt compelled to have President Biden call Mr. Zelensky, reassure him that we will continue to supply him, that we back him, there will be no change. And at the same time, Mr. Zelensky pleaded with more air defense systems because the Russian attacks also destroyed 80% of Ukrainian air defenses. So if someone is suggesting this was not consequential, we have to look at those developments and we rapidly conclude, no, that's wrong. Mr. Zelensky is in a panic, unquestionably. They've got serious logistical problems moving things around in the country. Suddenly, Russia has decided enough is enough. We're not going to exercise the restraint we have in the past.
Talking about the air defense system specifically, Ukrainian President Zelensky, as you mentioned, just asked for more weapons, just asked for specifically air defense weapons. The U.S. appears to be going along with it. The United States throwing their support, happy always to supply weapons wherever they are needed. What will this do for Ukraine? Air defense systems. Explain how those would work. And who would man, are they unmanned? Would these be NATO soldiers, Ukrainian soldiers who would be manning these air defense systems?
Well, keep in mind that the so-called HIMARS system, which is this high mobility rocket system, is largely manned by so-called contractors.
Right.
Presumably that consists of Americans in civilian clothes, working on contract for the Ukrainian government via some other mechanism that we've created. Could also be Europeans, but these systems take a long time to learn how to operate, let alone maintain. Now, something called NASAMS, which is a surface-to-surface and surface-to-air missile system designed to protect point targets with a very complex radar system, it's one of the best in the world, was in Kyiv, and it's being destroyed. The way you overwhelm point air defense systems is that you launch lots of missiles and rockets. And eventually you're going to overwhelm any system, regardless of how good it is. That's what the Russians did in this operation. They targeted air defense sites and overwhelmed them. So yes, Mr. Zelensky wants more of these, but then he's also got to have contractors operate them because his soldiers are not trained to do it.
So where do NATO forces play in the rest of this? Now, if we talk about this turning point, this decimation of the Ukrainian military, I've heard, you know, you talk about this before, but you're eliminating their best soldiers, who whatever's left of the Ukrainian military as they're being drawn out, they're being eliminated. To replace them is not easy, and arguably, I guess you're replacing them with NATO soldiers or contractors. Who's going to fill the who's going to man the ship once the rest of the Ukrainian army is destroyed?
Well, the people engaged in direct fire combat on the ground are Ukrainians. Now, there are reports of large numbers of Polish soldiers in Ukrainian uniform making up for losses that occurred over the last few months. Because, as you point out, most of Ukraine's best forces are gone. They've been killed or wounded. Ukrainians have lost roughly 100,000 dead, perhaps 2, 3, even 400,000 wounded. Wow. They started out with an army of 600,000. Remember, we spent 8 years building this army up with the express purpose of attacking Russia. That's what it was designed to do. That's why the Russians attacked it. And ultimately, we wanted to put missiles into eastern Ukraine with which we could threaten Russia. So again, eastern Ukraine had to be neutralized, and that's why the Russians intervened. But the Russians, as I pointed out earlier, have always exercised great restraint because, first of all, this is another Slavic country, another Orthodox Christian Slavic country. They're not interested in killing large numbers of people. They didn't want to destroy a lot of infrastructure. The areas where Russian forces are sitting in southern and eastern Ukraine were already Russian. They simply wanted to guarantee equal rights for the Russians in Ukraine with other Ukrainian citizens. That was the point of the Minsk agreements, which were never honored. So the bottom line is, at this point, you're looking at cannon fodder. People without much training being rounded up, put into uniform, handed an AK-47, put behind machine guns, whatever else, put into tanks and armored fighting vehicles. Do they get training? Some have had good training, but the vast majority haven't had much. So the casualties have been very high. But once you move above the tactical level and you move up to what we would call division or corps levels, you find NATO staffs are actually running the show. In other words, people from France, Great Britain, the United States, other countries are doing this, the systematic planning and setting forth proposals for what should happen next.
Right.
There's a lot of evidence that the Ukrainian president has not taken our advice very well, and he's determined to attack, largely because I think he sees himself in a position where he has everything to lose and not much more to gain. So he thinks he can wear down the Russians. The problem is, for every one Russian killed or wounded, you have 5, 6, or 7 Ukrainians being killed or wounded. So for the Russians, they've economized. They've run a fairly cheap, inexpensive defense, while the Ukrainians have run very expensive offenses. So now Ukraine is in a very serious crisis. It may not survive, particularly when this major offensive begins in November, December timeframe and the ground is frozen. I don't know what the Ukrainians will do, because then they will face the regular Russian army, large numbers of Russian army troops, not just volunteers and allied units, but the Russian army, and it will have the operational freedom to do what many Russians wanted to do at the beginning, which is anything that we suspect is dangerous or threatening to us can be targeted and destroyed. So it'll be a very different war that's coming.
And so you see that happening in November, coming up here in the next few weeks, this amassing of forces. Yeah. I think a lot of people have been wondering, when is that going to occur? You see that happening within the next few weeks?
Let's be frank, I'm not on distribution from the Russian general staff. But right. When I look at the arrival of Russian forces in the theater, and they're arriving in groups of 50,000 spread around Ukraine and various places, they're doing a lot of training and preparation right now. They will then move to axes, operational axes of advance, something we expected to see at the beginning of the war that we did not see. And then they will strike very hard and very deep. And whatever is still in front of Russian forces in Ukraine will be annihilated. That will be their mission. Destroy them, annihilate them. Now, where will the Russians stop? I suspect they'll stop at the Dnieper River. They've never been interested in crossing that. They don't want to go into what is historically Ukraine, which is west of the river. That's where the Ukrainians live. They're not Russified. They are real Ukrainians. He doesn't want to go over there. But he's going to take Odessa. He's going to take Kharkov. These cities will be taken once and for all as a result of these offenses. And then there's not a great deal we can do, anybody in the West, unless they want to go with to war with Russia. I see no appetite anywhere in Europe for anyone to go to war with Russia, with a possible exception of the Poles. And even there, the consensus supporting war against Russia is cracking, slowly but surely. In the United States, no one's even interested. Everybody's talking about the hurricane that struck Florida. No one really cares what happens in Ukraine. That's why we've gotten away with so many bad policy decisions, because Americans didn't pay attention. Well, they're not really paying much attention now, but they're beginning to see that perhaps everything they were told about this is wrong.
Yeah, and you've been one of the keenest voices on this, providing that truth, and that's what we try to do here on this show. And we've been saying Odessa, we've been talking about Odessa over the past few weeks on this show, that will be key. At this point, it's not been, obviously not part of the referenda, but if pushed, Odessa will fall. It will become part of Russia. And then what? Ukraine landlocked. No access to water. What becomes of Ukraine and what becomes of Zelensky once that happens?
Well, that's anybody's guess. I couldn't even begin to conjecture what would happen to Zelensky. He could be removed by his own people. He could simply get onto an aircraft and fly to one of his mansions in Miami or Venice or somewhere else that have been provided to him. I have no idea. But as far as the Russians are concerned, Odessa has always been a Russian city. It was never part of Ukraine. The same thing is true for Kharkov. These were Russian cities from the very, very beginning, and they were Russian speaking. Now, that doesn't mean Ukrainians haven't moved in there, and they have in many cases. In Odessa, for instance, almost 50% of the population now consists of Ukrainians because they pushed a lot of Russians out. Right. But from the vantage point of Moscow at this stage, they're not going to tolerate that nonsense any longer. They're going to take these places. But they're going to do it as the Russians always do things, very methodically, very deliberately. And this new commander who's just been named is a very able person. He has a great reputation. He did good work in Syria for the Russians. And he is a tough-minded individual. He's now going to have forces, and he's going to have capabilities at his disposal that his predecessors have never had. That's why I think the Washington Post suggested this is a turning point. They're right. It is. It may not be what they think, but it's a turning point.
Maybe also part of this turning point, and I'll get you out of here on this question, Colonel, which is about Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko on Monday said that Belarus and Russia have agreed now to deploy a military joint force in response to tensions along the western borders. Lukashenko also said that Ukraine is discussing plans to launch attacks on Belarus. So this is a preemptive move. Can you speak to that?
I can only tell you that Belarus has a population of perhaps 8 million. So it's, even though its landmass is large, its population is small. Its army has not modernized over the last several decades, and the Russians are now trying to hastily modernize it, provided new equipment, new communications equipment, perhaps even new tactical organization. That will not happen overnight. What I think we're talking about now is the Russians coming in, integrating with the Belarusians, and they speak the same language. There's no longer any great distinction between so-called White Russia and Great Russia. There was, but certainly not since the Second World War. And I think they'll be more concerned about defending the border against any interest that Poland may have in attacking them. Because remember, Minsk is a city that was historically in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. It's this notion of a White Russia, it was further east. So you've got all of these historical interests at play. And this is the final point that I need to make. We have no role in this. This is not part of our world. And the only interest we have in this place is in bringing peace to it. Right. We should be working to end this thing, not make it worse. Because if we try to make it worse, it will spread and engulf others for the reasons I just outlined. There are many people, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Poland, Slovakia, they all have agendas that involve territory, populations. And that's not our agenda. We don't want to be involved in that. We just want them to get through this with minimal loss of life and get back to business. And if you're going to argue, well, the Russian army is too small and too incompetent to threaten anyone, but on the other hand, that Mr. Putin harbors the ambition to conquer Europe and invade NATO. You can't have them both way.
Right.
So the point is, no, there's no interest in attacking NATO, and there's no interest in a war with NATO. We should recognize that and find as quickly as possible a solution that people can live with. It won't be as good as it would have been several months ago. Ukraine is going to look at the loss of territory. But this has happened repeatedly over 1,000 years in Europe. This is nothing new. You have to make peace, and that will include some changes that some people may not like.
Well, we've been calling for peace on this show from the very beginning, and I think absolutely right now would be a wonderful time for them to come back to the table and say, enough is enough, enough is enough.
Yes.
I agree with you on that. Colonel, great to see you. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you will come back on the show. We hope it may, perhaps it's under better circumstances.
Sure. Great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Colonel.
Bye-bye.
So thanks to the Colonel for joining us there. And, you know, it's interesting. His analysis is, I think, spot on. And so we, over the next few weeks, are going to see a massive move by Vladimir Putin. So we'll be watching that very, very closely over the next few weeks into November. It is interesting to see, though, over the past few hours and past 24 hours, what the deep state cabal really wants. You just read the front page of Drudge, which is basically like a mouthpiece for the Biden administration calling for all-out war.
Yes.
With Putin. I mean, that's exactly what the deep state cabal wants right now. They want full-scale war. And you're seeing now the battle lines being drawn. And there's an opportunity. I see like the conservative leader in Canada tweeting out support for NATO. So you're seeing like, really? You're seeing these deep staters, these globalists who are continuing to push for an escalation of this war. And that's why today we saw Tulsi Gabbard come out. So Tulsi Gabbard, Democrat, coming out, former presidential candidate, and she left the Democratic Party today officially by saying that she can't support these deep state globalists anymore who are warmongering, pushing for an endless war. Listen to what Tulsi Gabbard had to say.
I can no longer remain in today's Democratic Party that's under the complete control of an elitist cabal of warmongers who are driven by cowardly wokeness, who divide us by racializing every issue and stoking anti-white racism, who actively work to undermine our God-given freedoms that are enshrined in our Constitution, who are hostile to people of faith and spirituality, who demonize the police but protect criminals at the expense of law-abiding Americans, who believe in open borders, who weaponize the national security state to go after their political opponents, and above all, who are dragging us ever closer to nuclear war. Now, I believe in a government that's of the people, by the people, and for the people. Unfortunately, today's Democratic Party does not. Instead, it stands for a government that is of, by, and for the powerful elite. Now, I'm calling on my fellow common sense, independent-minded Democrats to join me in leaving the Democratic Party. If you can no longer stomach the direction that the so-called woke Democratic Party ideologues are taking our country, then I invite you to join me.
Ouch.
All right. I mean, it's going to be open season on her now. It already was. They were already extremely uncomfortable with her straight shooting. And now they're just going to be able to sort of take her out with the trash and say she doesn't speak for us. We don't care about her. Right?
Oh, she'll get vilified. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. But this will make it easier for them. But she still has a strong platform, and she is willing to say, I don't vote for laws that ultimately hurt people and help the elitist. And she knows exactly how it works, and she's not wrong.
We've got four weeks until the election in the United States of America for the midterm election. You are going to see, this is why, guys, pay attention to what's happening right now. They are ramping up. They are trying to lead us towards a nuclear war with Russia. They are trying to use this. In fact, we got word that the Biden administration was trying to push the Saudis on this oil issue and asking them basically to hold their decision on cutting these 3 million barrels of oil until after the American election. That's what the Biden administration has been pushing for. So, hey, help us politically. Don't raise gas prices. Wait till after the election. election. When we win, then go ahead and cut all the oil barrels you want and then raise our oil prices,
Yes, but there's a 40-year precedence of the United States and Saudi Arabia working together to even put petrodollar recycling in the United States dollar currency so that the United States could print money in order to pay for things all around the world. So they've been buds for so long. I think what they're so shocked is that they're not willing to do it now after sort of a 40-year relationship. It was so cozy for so long that, you know, it's kind of like when you've had one of those friends who stands up to you, it's like your Crabbe and Goyle stand up to you and your Malfoy, you're like, What just happened?
You just got punched in the face.
Right.
We've got more news to get to. I should remind you, when you do subscribe here on the channel, your name will pop right up here on the big screen. And please go ahead and smash that like button. Push us out to further people who need to see this show. When you do that, when you smash the like button, it pushes us further out in the algorithm. It really helps us reach a larger audience who need to be, who we want in this.
Who would enjoy this conversation with
us? Yes, that's a good way to put it. Okay, we've got more news to get to. We're going to talk about who orchestrated the terror attack on the Crimean Bridge. We'll talk about that in a moment. We're also going to look at Bosnia in chaos. First ever recount election that they're dealing with in that country. They're not prepared for it. And there is, of course, protests in the streets. We're also going to look at the very latest on the Dutch farmer revolt and why they are losing this battle, sadly, to the World Economic Forum. But first, we've got a major update now on the terrorist attack on the Crimean Bridge. A short time ago, I sat down with Gray Zone reporter Kit Clarenberg, who has a bombshell story. Watch. Well, over the weekend, Ukrainian special forces carried out a terror attack on the Kerch Bridge to Crimea. Did they do it by themselves? That became the immediate question. It didn't seem like they would have been able to carry this out by themselves. Or did they have help from NATO or other Western powers? Well, now we have our answers. Thanks to investigative journalist Kit Clarenberg from the Gray Zone, Kit obtained leaked government documents from British intelligence spies that shows the United Kingdom was working directly with the Ukrainian special forces to carry out the attack on the Kerch Bridge. Kit Clarenberg, investigative journalist from the Gray Zone, joins us now. Kit, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
When did you learn about the British involvement in this attack?
I mean, in the immediate aftermath of the truck bombing, there was a very revealing article in The Cradle, which I urge all of your viewers to follow regularly. They put out excellent content. It was authored by an analyst called Pepe Escobar, and it effectively talked about how he'd been informed by a source within the Russian intelligence services that it was likely to have been Britain's Foreign Intelligence Service, MI6, that was involved in this. I think that Britain's role in stirring up the Ukrainian war and pushing Kiev to engage in dangerous escalations is a story that's little told and little understood, but is very, very obvious. So, you know, being in possession of these documents would show that back in April, at the precise time that Boris Johnson was doing everything in his power to sabotage what had, you know, to that point been successful peace talks between Kiev and Moscow. He specifically flew to visit Zelensky and told him, "We're not ready for you to back down yet." There were these this constellation of British military and intelligence officials, veterans like Chris Donnelly, who was a long-time NATO Secretary General Advisor, Guy Spindler, who's an MU, a long-time MI6 officer who was posted in Moscow at the in the late 80s and early 90s at the same time as Christopher Steele, you know, author of the dodgy Trump-Russia dossier. I can't say that I was at all surprised. And yes, at precisely this time when the sabotage is being undertaken, they are plotting a major escalation of the comprehensive destruction of the Kerch Bridge. The explosion which took place on the 8th of October, I mean, you know, it pales in comparison to, what was put together by this rather shadowy and obscure veteran British Army operative, Hugh Ward, at the request of Chris Donnelly. And it's, this was a wide-ranging plan to completely cripple the bridge. No consideration for, you know, civilian casualties, which would have likely been high. That bridge is used by tens of thousands of people, you know, pretty much daily, you know, going back and forth. I mean, you know, there was a lot of talk about the recent Russian missile strikes, which remain ongoing against civilian in infrastructure in Ukraine, about how it was the missiles were raining down at rush hour. If that bridge had been hit even by the truck bomb at rush hour, then deaths would have been in the hundreds, in the thousands, very easily. So, a completely reckless disregard for human life and civilian casualties, and indeed the almost certain likelihood that this would have triggered an absolutely massive retaliation from Moscow, which again, what actually took place on Monday and again continues to this day, it pales in comparison to what they would and could have done.
So it seems, a couple of questions popped to my mind. Number one, this was a provocation then, right? This was on purpose to get Moscow to retaliate. No?
Yeah, there is that sense of it. I also just genuinely think that because Zelensky's Western backers and advisors just have no care or consideration for the consequences whatsoever, because it's not going to be felt in London or Washington. It's going to be felt in Kiev and other cities like Lviv. I think there is an element of, there was a lot of bluff calling, and particularly given that in the since this much vaunted Kursk counter offensive started in September, the Ukrainians have recaptured a not insignificant swath of territory. Although there's analysis by Jacques Baud, who's a former Swiss intelligence officer, who says that this was actually been rather disastrous for the Ukrainians, because they are attacking areas which are effectively hollowed out and have very few Russian and allied troops in them, and they're still losing thousands of soldiers. To paraphrase Mao, territory can easily be recaptured. Experienced, trained, battle-hardened soldiers are very, very, very difficult to replace. They literally cannot be replaced immediately. So I think that these gains from the Western perspective perhaps emboldened the Ukrainians and their Western backers to carry this out. And I think there was a symbolic element to it, of carrying it out on Vladimir Putin's 70th birthday. When Putin opened the bridge in 2018, he praised the miracle of its construction, and suggested that he had fulfilled the dreams of czars and commissars before him. And yes, in its immediate aftermath, there was much celebration. And a senior Ukrainian intelligence official posted on Twitter a video which contrasted Marilyn Monroe singing "Happy Birthday, Mr. President" to John F. Kennedy to a video of the bridge in flames. And then, miraculously quickly, there was a commemorative postage stamp of the bridge on fire released in Ukraine, which does tend to suggest that they were waiting to do this for a very long time. Whether they've been waiting since April isn't clear, although there are clear indications from the content that the Grey Zone came into possession of, that this mad proposal to completely destroy Kerch Bridge was shared with Ukrainian security and intelligence services at the highest levels.
That's what I was wondering as well. You talked about if this plan had actually carried out the way that, according to these documents, it would have been absolutely devastating. And this commemorative stamp comes out by the Ukrainian Postal Service almost immediately, showing multiple explosions. It seems this coordination of having a stamp printed that you could get your photos taken in front of, taken selfies of. It seems like obviously this was planned. So can we glean anything from those postage stamps? Was that to be the case, that there were to be multiple explosions at either end of the bridge and that didn't happen?
Well, yeah, The plans themselves that the Grey Zone has reported on, they talk about targeting specific sections of the bridge which are effectively in shallow water. And Hugh Ward, this Dr. Strangelove-esque figure, suggested it would be easy using specialist scuba divers underwater drones to attack and destroy these. So yes, the fact that there are two explosions at either end of the bridge is in the hastily released commemorative postage stamp does tend to suggest that that was the original plan. And there's a direct parallel there. Perhaps it was decided that it would be too difficult. In the manner it was carried out, using a truck, allegedly It seems the driver was unwittingly carrying a vast amount of explosives and had been hired to ferry some fertilizer from Bulgaria to Crimea. I mean, that in itself does tend to raise questions about whether there was a British hidden hand in this. I mean, in several major terrorist attacks in the UK in recent years, there have been clear indications that the perpetrators were unwitting in the sense that they didn't realize they were on a suicide mission. On the July 7th, 2005 tube and bus bombings in London, all of the alleged terrorists bought return tickets, which nothing suggests they thought they were coming back home after doing whatever it was they were doing in London.
Unbelievable. And that was going to be another question I had, which was this the driver of this truck unwittingly a participant in this? And that just speaks to the horror of this, that that the British, you know, the British intelligence, along with Ukrainian special forces, thought this is great. We can take an unwitting citizen, a civilian, load up his truck with explosives, and he won't know anything about it, and we'll wait to make this detonation. Just speaks to the horrors of this event.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's just, it's really quite extraordinary. So the kind of the outpouring of euphoria, or, you know, about what was, you know, could plausibly be argued to be a grave war crime, which claimed the lives of innocent civilians. And, you know, as I said, if it had been conducted at rush hour, would have meant a lot more dead people. And yes, a far more brutal response. I mean, I do think that that kind of, that total disregard for consequences now, is kind of filtering along from London and Washington, because they believe they have the unquestioning and unconditional support of their Western backers. There are very clear indications that that's not true. I mean, it just, and also it doesn't make logical sense. I mean, the day will it almost inevitably come when Ukraine is one way or another thrown under the bus. It's just a matter of when. I mean, I think apart from the most insane, hawkish excesses of Western military and intelligence services, of which the people who plotted this bridge destruction, you know, are a palpable manifestation. I don't think that the more sober people in the Pentagon or MI6 actually want nuclear war. And that is a very obvious outcome of continuing to escalate an already dangerous situation.
Who, you mentioned the author of this. So who authored the blueprint for this terrorist attack?
Well, it was drawn up, as I say, by Hugh Ward, who was a veteran British military operative. But it was commissioned by Chris Donnelly. I mean, Chris Donnelly has been heavily involved in stirring up tension in Ukraine ever since the Maidan coup, if not before. In March 2014, he put together this appalling and just completely reckless plan, which would have involved mining Sevastopol harbor, destroying the Russian air force parked in parked on Crimean airfields. And he mentions, I'm trying to get this message across. I mean, quite who he was trying to get it across to isn't clear from the document itself, but again, it would be unsurprising if he had direct ties to the kind of post-coup government and the Ukrainian security services. And there's a very interesting character who crops up in the leaked emails which accompanied this document, called Audrius Butkevičius, who is a Lithuanian anti-communist activist who led the kind of 1991 revolution, and in doing so he directed his comrades into the line of Soviet sniper fire, knowing that they would be killed in order to inflame tensions and, you know, kind of encourage revolution, and he then served as Lithuania's first kind of post-communist defense minister, and since then seems to have been involved in a number of fairly dubious dark schemes in close proximity with some rather sinister actors. He was for many years a co-owner of the key company that was involved in ferrying arms to Ukraine for the civil war in the Donbass, kind of, you know, off books, as it were, you know, kind of flying under the radar. So, I mean, and yes, he's repeatedly named as being in direct contact with Hugh Ward, who drew up these plans. And but there are also indications, which were on based on material we haven't yet reported on, that he's in direct contact with the Ukrainian security services. So again, that's another kind of tangential but still direct link between the people who drew this up and the, you know, alleged perpetrators.
And yeah, I'm curious about the Ukrainian special forces involvement in this. How integral were they in the planning of this, or was it really just the carrying out of this attack? Do we know?
I mean, we don't yet know for certain. I mean, there was a very strange incident in which in the immediate hours following this, after, you know, all of this celebration and the release of the commemorative postage stamp, the Ukrainian media reported on the fact that sources within Ukrainian law enforcement had stated it was categorically that it was the Ukrainian security services. The Ukrainian government seems to be backtracking significantly on that now, and one of Zelensky's chief advisors has said, "Oh no, actually this is a Russian false flag. It's very clear to see," and all this other stuff. I mean, whether they were just in charge of pressing the detonator, or whether they played a more active role, isn't certain. Although I think, as I say, look into the role of Bulgaria in this. I think that the Ukrainians, given the composition of Bulgaria's government, and indeed a great swathes of public opinion, I don't think that the Ukrainians could operate there with such impunity. I mean, the British, by contrast, act with impunity everywhere they go. Something to look into.
One more question just on this piece, which is in the documents, and you don't have to tell me if your reporting hasn't uncovered it yet, or it's not fully vetted, which is, do these documents point to other terrorist attacks in this planning similar to this, or is this an isolated plan that you were able to obtain these documents around?
Well, I mean, you know, if you look at the proposal document, which is embedded in the article and is free to download, and you know, other media outlets are welcome to report on it, and they're invited to, and I don't think they will. But the Kerch Bridge destruction, which was, you know, that was the exact phrase used, that was one component, although it was the only one to have a dedicated annex outlining how it could and indeed should be done, and the various methods to achieve it, which kind of underlines how this was a key area of interest for Donnelly and his, yes, kind of sinister transnational clique of military and intelligence operatives. But yes, the proposals were very wide-ranging and involved, you know, attacks on Russian shipping, moving mines surreptitiously so to unblock Ukrainian ports while damaging Russian vessels and all sorts. And again, you know, each and every proposal is the kind of thing which would provoke a massive retaliation. The Russians have made abundantly clear over and over again that they would consider attacks on territory that they claim as theirs, which obviously includes Crimea, would be taken as attacks on the, you know, the Russian Federation itself, and, you know, therefore subject to massive retaliation. And again, there was a period of inactivity when, after, you know, Alexander Dugin's daughter was blown up, and all sorts of other kind of connivances were carried out. And then, you know, now we are seeing those threats made very, very real, and there is no indication that this is going to stop anytime soon. There are videos circulating on the internet. They haven't been fully verified as yet, but they seem to show, you know, Ukrainians fleeing large cities en masse, not only because of fear of the destruction, but also because, you know, they can't access water or electricity. You know, Russia is doing now what the US and allied forces did in Iraq from day one, which is just, yes, target civilian infrastructure, absolutely cripple it, wage an effective terror campaign on the local population. And, you know, I've seen some takes where people have kind of, you know, pro-Ukrainian supporters online have suggested that the airstrikes on Monday were not actually particularly significant, and they were primarily symbolic, and they were for a domestic audience. You are absolutely kidding yourself if you don't think this damages Ukraine's warfighting capability. I mean, how are they going to be able to recharge electronic devices and communicate with each other? And that's just one small upshot of this wider campaign, which, as I say, shows no signs of abating and may continue for weeks.
Yeah, and earlier this afternoon we had attacks on multiple fuel depots as well as arms depots. So they are, you know, and going after NATO targets as well, well-known NATO targets within the country as well. So this is just getting, it's going to be getting much, much worse, it appears, if these provocations continue. Kit Clarenberg, thank you so much for your reporting on this. We really appreciate it. Unbelievable journalism, as always, from what Kit does and the team at the Gray Zone. Thanks again, Kit, for joining us on the show.
Cheers, Clayton. God bless you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, the Gray Zone, probably, to my mind, one of the greatest independent media publications doing a fantastic investigative journalism. Max Blumenthal, Aaron Maté, who else do we have over there? Lindsay Snell and Kit Clarenberg. If I missed anyone over there, it's a small team, but they do amazing, amazing work. So,
yeah, they have fans all over the world. In fact, Roger Waters mentioned him on the Joe Rogan podcast last week about a place that you can go for legitimate information about Syria and many places around the world. So, I mean, that is it is a bombshell report, right? To think about the repercussions of something that may have been orchestrated by the UK government.
Yeah,
What end, right? To right. What end? To hurt innocent civilians and bring about these repercussions.
Right, to further stoke war instead of, you know, to his point, flying, you know, Boris Johnson flying there on a regular basis, telling them to not push for peace and to sabotage any peace negotiations. I see a lot of people here in our chat, like, let us know right now if you're from the UK. I saw a lot of people just saying right now, you know, I'm from the UK and I'm ashamed of my country. Hey, welcome to the club. You know, like, what? Right. How many of us are like super thrilled with our countries right now, especially our government? But
who just don't want to be behind this warmongering, who just want peace talks at whatever cost.
MI6, the CIA, these guys who are fomenting these, you know, this is the deep state, guys. This is what the deep state does. These permanent sort of intelligence complex that it doesn't matter who's in charge. Liz Truss, Boris Johnson, it doesn't matter. But Joe Biden, Donald Trump, the deep state is there and they're driving this. They're driving us into the ground so they can continue to push for war. Hey, we've got a lot more news to get to here on the show on this Tuesday night, this Taco Tuesday night. We're going to talk about Bosnia and the recount election that's unfolding there. And there's protests in the street. This is not something this country has ever had to handle before. So we're going to dive deeply into what's going on in Bosnia. We're also going to look at the Dutch farmers who are becoming incredibly desperate because they are losing to the World Economic Forum. They're losing to these globalists who are pushing to take away their farms. It's trickling into Germany and into New Zealand. We'll look more closely at that.
All right, but first we'd like to tell you about our friends at ScoreMaster. Charging higher interest rates is how banks make more money, obviously, and they take a lot more out of your hard-earned money if your credit score is just okay, but not great. So ScoreMaster, the new science in accelerating credit scores, puts you in control of your money, not the bank. So let's say your credit score is around $700, and you're borrowing $500 to refinance your home. Starting at ScoreMaster, then you can save over $75,000 over the life of your loan. That's $75,000 of your money, not to the bank. That's the genius behind ScoreMaster's 3-week rule, especially now with soaring interest rates. No matter your credit score, before you apply for any bank loan product, auto lease, credit, whatever, start at ScoreMaster. It only takes a minute to get started, and you can add between 60 to 100 points in about 3 weeks. Life has enough regrets. Don't add to it by paying higher interest rates. To that list of regrets, visit scoremaster.com/redacted for your special 7-day trial. Again, it's scoremaster.com/redacted for your 7-day trial is waiting for you. You know you are an adult when you get super excited about things like saving, amortization, mm-hmm. right? Good interest rates and good credit scores.
That's right.
Yeah, those things get me hot under the collar.
Yes, that's right. Indeed, we do get excited about that stuff as adults. I should mention here, if you are subscribed to the channel, your name will pop right up here. Thank you for your super chats as well. We are going to get to some of your super chats at the end of the show. So thank you, Dom Izzy, 626 for your super chat. And thanks to all of you for subscribing and pushing us further out into the algorithm. We really, really appreciate that.
I am the most awkward glasses wearer in the world. I just can't get used to, because they're readers, not mucking them up when I touch them.
Just don't put your fingers on the lenses.
I don't. I think my eyes breathe. I just can't figure out how to do this. Why do some people make this look so cool and I cannot?
Well, because you just started wearing them.
I know.
So you're getting old.
Yes, I'm about just like three or four months
great,
into glasses wearing. But every time I want to go to a store and I put them on, I'm like, what the? Who did this?
And she, yeah, and she's constantly like not, and she doesn't know what to do with them. So she's like, here's my glasses, guys. And I don't know what to do.
All right, I'll rewatch the show later, and I've put it on, and one of my hairs is like. Because I just can't. I don't know. Okay, I'm going to try not to be awkward, guys, because
good
we're
going
to move into this next story. I do need my glasses. Let's see. Hands in the air. Okay. We're going to talk about the presidential election in Bosnia because the state of Bosnia and Herzegovina had a presidential election on October 2nd. So you'd think it'd be a done deal, but it's not because they have yet to declare a winner. Could it be because the person who won was not supposed to win? This is the big question. Why? Because he was not the candidate that NATO wanted to win. So now votes are being recounted after protests raged over the weekend. Now, you will forgive me. I'm going to shorten the name of this country to Bosnia for ease of reporting.
Instead of saying Herzegovina?
It just doesn't come off nicely of my extremely Anglo accent, so you will forgive me. The Election Commission announced on Monday that they will recount the results in Sarajevo. They will particularly focus on the votes that came from the Serb-run states, which were previously counted in each respective election office. The candidate that had declared victory is the incumbent, Milorad Dodik. He is an ethnic Serb. The West used to really like him, but that has changed in recent years. He actually has been sanctioned by the West since before the conflict in Ukraine because of alleged corruption and the fact that he advocates for the separation of the Serb Republic from the Federation of Bosnia. Now, these are the two regions in Bosnia. The Federation is largely made up of Croat Bosnian population. This is a crude explanation of the ethnic divisions that have persisted in this region for decades. And many say, look, it never really was going to work, having two federations in one independent state. But NATO likes it that way. It was actually NATO that came up with this system in 1995 in what is called the Dayton Agreement. The Dayton Agreement, you may not know, comes from the city of Dayton, Ohio. And if you're wondering what the bleep does Ohio have to do with Bosnian geography? Well, Ohio is the location of the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and that's where this arrangement was hammered out.
Where I used to live in Dayton, Ohio.
Yes.
Miamisburg.
What do you call it? The fast food.
Well, no,
world.
What's interesting about Dayton, Ohio is I don't know if they've changed this, but the Chamber of Commerce of Dayton, Ohio considers themselves America's most average city, and they. I don't know if they've changed that, but that used to be what the Chamber of Commerce said on purpose.
So I don't think you can say that anymore. That's unwoke.
Wait, no, the reason
I thought that was Muncie, Indiana.
Well, no, like, I guess there's going to be a fight
No, because they actually did a huge study in the 70s of Muncie, Indiana called the Midtown Studies, and it was scientifically proven to be the most average, like basically like the last place any trend ended up in the United States was Muncie, Indiana.
No, well, these...
Because I went to Ball State.
Well, yeah, but Dayton, Ohio, so they... I forget which intersection. There's a major cross-country intersection. I forget the highways off the top of my head. But they would test out all of the new chain restaurants right at that intersection. So Joe's Crab Shack, the Olive Garden...
Macaroni Grill.
Like, they all got their start testing out in that intersection. Because people are traveling across the country and they stop there at the hotels, it's a good test bed. So America's most average city, Dayton, Ohio, was responsible for the Dayton Accords,
home of the two federation system in Bosnia. You might have known that, and also apparently Macaroni Grill. The Dayton agreements put an end to NATO's air campaign called Operation Deliberate Force. Operation Deliberate Force was the first major combat mission from NATO, and it was a doozy. It involved over 1,026 bombs from 400 aircrafts and 5,000 personnel from 15 nations. Now, at the time, NATO said they were doing this to stop the ethnic genocide happening during the Bosnian War. But in recent years, Bosnian politicians refute that, including President Dodik. He has said that these genocides were, quote, a fabricated myth. Now, this is where my Western internet will just not really allow me to go. And I have to admit to you that in one afternoon, it's really hard to go down this rabbit hole. I can only find articles in English saying that he says this. And every time the Western press covers this, they say, isn't this crazy that he says this? In fact, the United Nations has tried really hard to prevent him and other politicians from saying this. They tried to pass a law in Bosnia to make it illegal for anyone to deny the atrocities, but Bosnian parliament nullified it last year. So it is still legal in Bosnia right now to say that this was, but for now, right? Mm-hmm. You're looking uncomfortable. Like, can we say these kind of things? Do you want to
stop me if you've heard this one? No,
before?
Just a lot of people have a lot to say about Dudic. Is it Dudic or Dodik? Because a lot
are
saying
I'm saying it wrong. It is Dodik or Dodik.
Right. So people are saying,
I'm sorry.
It is Dodik. Dodik. Yes.
I've heard it both ways. I don't know if the I is hard. I know it is with a hard K, not a ch at the end. I already apologized for my Anglo accent.
So there's no hard I in Dodik.
Okay. Yeah, it's really hard to say Dodik. So you just got to be really careful.
Stop it. Stop.
Sorry. It's Testosterone Taco Tuesday. What do you expect from these men? These men who, we got to laugh from this, you know?
No, we shouldn't be laughing because I'm trying to get to the bottom of whether or not this genocide was actually something that NATO acted upon to rain hell on Bosnia.
That's exactly what happened. So let's talk about the genocide piece of this. We absolutely know that that's what happened. NATO absolutely used the, basically launched an attack on this area and then later claimed there was genocide. That's exactly what happened. So just ask any journalist who covers this area, what's the truth about this? And that's absolutely the truth about this. Creating justification for an invasion for 78 days of hell raining down on the people there. That's absolutely what happened. Let us know in the chat if you disagree with us on that, if for some reason. And yes, there were people killed. It was not a genocide.
Well, actually, both presidential candidates admit that this is not a word that they should be using in when they talk about this 1995 incidents, which then would beg the question, what is the justification for that NATO strike, for the hell that rained down in 1995? And what is the justification for the continued NATO presence there, which we are going to talk about in a minute? These are big questions. But also, guess what else Dodik is for? Russian gas. He has a friendly relationship with Putin, and he has no problems with Russian gas at all. He is anti-freezing his people this winter. And when asked if he would reject Russian oil, he said no. And he proposed what he's calling an economic association of solidarity. So that's an interesting term. What does that mean? An association of solidarity. So who would be in that? People who refuse to align with NATO priorities and band together? Obviously, you can see why NATO would say, I don't like that. I don't like hearing that. Here's what he said. He says, when asked about sanctions, the West must learn that communication is no longer possible from the position of demanding complete obedience and submission. Therefore, if the West wants to talk, it must respect our foreign policy priorities, of which the main one is successful cooperation with Russia. Of course, we're painting in broad strokes, but you can see where I'm going with this. A leader who refuses to go along with sanctions, anti-NATO, refuses to demonize Putin, refuses to admit things that the West needs him to admit in order to validate NATO, wants to cooperate with Russia. So the logical question for us to ask, is there a Western motivation to delegitimize his election?
Of course. And I see so many people in the chat saying, yes, there was no genocide in Bosnia. And here, let's just read this here. This is Goran Stodichev. Hold on, I gotta get this so it doesn't disappear on me. It goes so fast. So here's a super chat from Goran. Says, in the Hague court, they refused to accept as undeniable proof of no genocide official report from Muslim Army made in late 1995 on this matter, as it was not in line with the official narrative.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Goran, for that
yes,
super chat.
So, I mean, this is amazing. And if we look at then the opposition candidate, she is 39-year-old Yelena Trivik. Many are saying that she is Western aligned because she was educated in Europe, but she also, this is a tweet from her in 2021, refuses the genocide narrative, which delegitimizes NATO. So if you want to call her Western aligned, that's fine, but at least she, you know, you can, but she also does not go along with this NATO strike reigned in hell because of a genocide narrative. This tweet that I just showed you was translated by Twitter, so I apologize for the translation is not completely grammatical, but it says, the crime that happened in Srebrenica is not genocide. These are facts. Form subjects, but you won't change my attitude. Serbs are people who do not kneel before the occupier. Especially, they will not kneel before an imposed law. For us, this republic is sacred, and this is a direct attack on Serbia. So, early reports were that she lost the election by 30,000 votes, but now she says that there were irregularities. In over 3 million votes, she's saying that there were dozens of irregularities and that Dodic's, I don't know how to do the possessive, the thugs intimidated voters on election day, and that poll workers loyal to him changed votes. Now, if that's true, would a recount even do anything? Hmm. If the votes were changed, couldn't you see like eraser marks? Or you can't see paper trail of intimidation. Now, of course, I'm not giving enough time to her politics because this is just an overview of this issue. But I do think it's interesting to talk about who has increasing presence in Bosnia since midsummer as these elections heated up. Listen to who has conveniently come to camp out there.
NATO and the European Union have increased their presence in the region. The bloc has doubled the number of its peacekeepers in Bosnia in fear that instability caused by Russia and Ukraine could spread.
Okay, so NATO and the EU have doubled their presence there. Forgive me for being cynical, but are we led to believe then that they will work out the will of the people in that region and they're just there because they're altruistic and peacekeepers?
Well, of course.
I don't know, but that mission there is called Operation Althea. It is the NATO and EU military force that is there to, according to their website, maintain the safe and secure environment in the country. But they're also there to count weapons, to count resources. They say they're there to recycle weapons too. It's a major presence in this region. And of course, Russia has spoken out against it as military creep. And especially since over the summer, Germany is adding 50 troops at a time. They are the most recent country to participate in Operation Althea. So now there are over 20 countries participating. This is why the stakes are really high for this recount. And it absolutely is one to watch because NATO has made themselves comfortable. They've taken off their shoes and they are there to stay, they say.
All right, so someone in the chat said that the EU just also took away $7 billion in aid as well to this area. So that's not surprising as well.
And they're playing a very similar game as they're playing with Serbia of, oh, you don't really want to join the EU membership, then we're going to, you know, play with your, this kind of, are you really serious about being a part of EU? That kind of rhetoric.
And also when you think about like, here's your test, here's your petri dish of an idea. Like, look at what the UK has done in support of Russian sanctions and what it's gotten its people. Here's what Germany has done. Like, Germany's in trouble. We're going to speak in just a few minutes on Germany, and it's not good. It's getting bad there, really bad. And so that's your example. And Germans, by the way, as Colonel Douglas McGregor spoke about earlier, and I spoke to him, he said, the Germans are not used to this. Like, this is your example of what it's like to be a member of the EU and to call on, say, no to Russian gas, no to imports from that region, not throwing your support behind that, and watch your people freeze.
Yeah.
That's what's happening.
Right. And so this quote from the president there, whose name I shall no longer try to pronounce because it's a distraction, has said, we're not going to talk to you anymore when you have dangling carrots, right? So no more demanding complete obedience or else. This is not how reciprocity works, and we're done with that. And so obviously the West is like, well, we can't deal with somebody like this. And so they would really like a new leader there. So we'll see if that is the will of the people, or if it, this is just, another occurrence of the United States saying, this is not democracy unless we get our way.
We get our way. But if she loses by 30,000 votes, I think you bring up a great point, which is, okay, we have 30,000 votes that she says were irregularities and that his thugs were out in force intimidating people. In what way? To vote for him over her? And we're going to force you? What, I mean, is there any evidence at all of that? There's the thugs showing up at polling places with guns, right, forcing someone to vote a certain way? I haven't seen any of that.
Again, that wouldn't come out in a recount if you were just literally counting papers, because there's not a paper trail of intimidation.
Right.
Or maybe there's a code you could write, like,
or hanging
being
chads,
forced to vote, you know, that kind of thing. That's ridiculous. So we will see. And most of her speeches have said, look, we've given our evidence already and you will see. So we will absolutely see. But I think that it is interesting for those of us who live in the West to watch this a bit more closely.
Yeah. And you have to see this delicate balance that these leaders in the Balkans have to deal with, right? Which is to both kind of curry favor with the EU in some ways, but then also want to protect its people and to make sure that you're not freezing this winter by getting affordable Russian gas.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. I feel more educated on that. And you did a great job. Forget the name. It was fine. It was fine. We loved it. We loved it. People said, oh, you're in the doghouse. No.
Yeah, that's.
We don't have a doghouse. And I never spend time in the doghouse.
We were suggesting in chat that we were going to mount a super soaker under the table so that she can squirt it with your feet right into your crotch, so it looks like you wet your pants when you disrupt her, and nobody will even know.
I'll
except
just
you.
Kick him.
I love you. Literally thought of this idea. Like, how are we going to mount a super soaker?
Yes. We scheme some really crazy things when we're live.
Well, it's appropriate that you were doing it around this guy's name. Okay, we've got to be able to have some fun. Okay. We've got more news to get to here on this Taco Tuesday, and we are going to talk about what's happening in the Netherlands, a really important story. Let us know here how many of you are from the Netherlands. I saw a few people saying that they're from the Netherlands tonight. Please let us know what you're experiencing by way of the farmers there, and we will cover that story here in just a second. But first,
and I'll interrupt you and we'll see how you like that.
All right, try it.
See if you can play at this game.
See if you can throw,
my darling.
You can't throw this guy off his game. No.
We'll see.
Got to get up pretty early in the morning for that to happen.
Oh, we'll just see about that.
All right. But first, I want to tell you about our friends over at Stamps.com. Try to throw me off. You're not going to throw me off this holiday season, because holiday season has a funny way of sneaking up on us. In fact, Natalie's already started doing some of the Christmas shopping today. She actually asked me to hide some presents already in my secret stash of a place. So you know it's early for the Christmas season. And we prepare, but there's a lot of ordering of things. And look, we're seeing like a global supply chain crunch right now. And the last thing you want to be doing is like running to the post office and dealing with all of that craziness that comes from, who in the world would want to go to the post office during the holidays? Are you out of your mind? You would literally need to get some special help if that's you. So if you're a small business owner, you know how important it is to be ready for the insane holiday season. And if you haven't started preparing for the chaos of holiday mailing and shipping, you're already falling behind. Luckily, Stamps.com has everything you need to make your life a whole lot easier. It's the 24/7 post office that you can access from anywhere. No lines, no traffic, no hassle. So Stamps.com is your one-stop shop for all of your shipping and mailing needs. For more than 20 years, Stamps.com has been indispensable for over 1 million businesses. And if you're running an online store, Stamps.com works seamlessly with all of the major shopping carts and marketplaces. Makes it super, super easy. So all you need is a computer and a printer, and you're good to go. Get ahead of the holiday chaos this year. Get started with Stamps.com today. Sign up with promo code REDACTED for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. That's right, you'll get a free digital scale and free postage right to your house. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com and click on that microphone icon right at the top of the screen right there and enter the code REDACTED. Get a 4-week trial, free postage, digital scale at Stamps.com/redacted. Thanks to Stamps.com for supporting what we do here on Redacted. Well, life for Dutch farmers in the Netherlands has only gotten worse since our last report a few weeks ago. The government-imposed nitrogen standards have made it impossible, virtually impossible, to continue farming. 17,000 farmers at risk of being shut down, run out of business. Many farmers forced to sell their lands, destroy their livestock. The situation has only gotten worse since our last report, and the mainstream media is completely ignoring this story. I mean, it is really difficult to find any information in the mainstream media about this story. Ralph Schulhammer is an academic researcher. He's been studying this story very closely from the very beginning, and Ralph joins us again on the show to talk about it. Ralph, welcome back to the show.
Well, Clayton, thank you so much for having me again.
Absolutely. And, you know, the impetus for this was hearing from a viewer last night who wrote me this and said, can you guys give more attention to what's happening to the Dutch farmers? The government is still going to force to buy their properties despite all of the protests. And this viewer said a 43-year-old farmer had taken his life because it's just gotten so bad and didn't see any other way out of it. So it seems like it's gotten much worse, Ralph.
Yeah, it's continued to grind on. You are one of the few outlets that reports about this. There's a couple of people in the Netherlands who report about it. There's a New Zealand network that reports about it, because the situation, just as a quick footnote, is also getting worse for farmers in New Zealand. But the bureaucracy grinds on. It is in one sense almost remarkable that regardless of what the people say or regardless what the public sentiment is, they just move forward, right? And it's just starting to begin getting more and more this emergency measure character, which makes it even harder to formulate or to organize resistance. So this is really going to be a tough couple of months and coming up for the Dutch farmers, because as you correctly point out, it doesn't look like it's going to stop.
So we saw the numbers, and maybe we can get into some of the specifics here. So if we can refresh our viewers' memories on this, very strict nitrogen rules, forcing farmers to cull their livestock. We saw the map. We featured the map here on the show, which showed that a lot of farmers that live near more urban settings, if their farms kind of butted up against cities, it was a much stricter culling of livestock, killing of their livestock to reduce those nitrogen numbers near population centers, right? So, and we heard from farmers we featured here on the show that have said, look, they want to take our land because they want to build apartment complexes. They want to build shopping centers. That's the reason the numbers for these farmers in these more urban areas is worse off than it is for those who are far more rural. Can you talk a little bit about the specifics of which farms are affected by this?
Well, it's a combination of both, right? I think you correctly pointed out, for some, it is about the expansion of urban planning. There is this vision, if you want, to create this almost, you know, cross-border state with the Netherlands, with Belgium, with parts of Germany, kind of have this huge urban center that would include up to it about, you know, between 50 and 150 million people. So kind of there's a significant city planning element to it. But it combines itself with another element that we have been talking about before, which is kind of the environmental fanaticism that is also behind it. So the Dutch farmers, in a sense, are being squeezed from two sides. So on the one hand, you have these plans for urban expansion. And on the other hand, you have this idea that modern farming can be done with very limited input, right? Particularly when we talk about nitrogen, less fertilizer, that you can feed people who should eat less meat anyways, right? So it's of course, okay to reduce livestock. And this is, without getting off topic, this is not just a phenomenon that's happening in the Netherlands. You have almost, again, under the exclusion of any reporting, a similar development in Germany, where the idea is that by 2030, about 30% of all farming products should come from organic agriculture. And what, just as an example, what this would do to German farming would mean Germany would become from being independent in its food production, they would become a net grain importer. So after we had this great experience of how well it works to outsource your energy to Russia, apparently we are now trying in Europe to do the same thing with our food supply. Because if we cannot produce enough at home, be it the Netherlands, be it Germany or other countries where farmers are under similar pressure, well, where are you going to get the food from? Well, either people eat less, which I guess is one part of the plan, or you have to import it from somewhere.
Right. And that's exactly what's happening. And it seems draconian. We're seeing some pushback. We covered last night on the show in the UK, Liz Truss, whose popularity has plummeted. But it seems there is this movement, some awareness there about, hey, we can't just have our entire country covered in solar farms. We need to actually get back to farming again. We need food. We can't, instead of having solar farms, let's remove some of these solar farms and let's actually start to harvest this land. Let's start to raise livestock and actually move away from the rewilding movement of the UK. So you're seeing at least some awareness of this in the UK, but there doesn't seem to be this awareness about it in the Netherlands. Estimated 11,000 farms will have to close, 17,000 farmers to reduce their livestock. It seems like they are winning and the farmers are losing. Am I wrong about that?
Well, at the moment, it looks like it. I mean, the political representation of the farmers, as far as I can tell from the most recent polls, is still pretty strong. So this, again, it's not necessarily getting stronger, but it's still about 20 times what it was a couple of years back. So I think if there would be elections in the Netherlands, this would be a massive topic. And I think those who are on the side of the farmers would actually gain significant numbers of seats within the Dutch parliament. The problem is, and I'm glad you mentioned also the UK, a problem is that to some extent, even, let's say, more right-wing or conservative movements do sympathize with this idea that we can return to a, you know, less technologically advanced form of agriculture, that the idea of organic farming does have some appeal also in among those who otherwise, I think, would share our view of this whole thing. And we see this in another area, which is this idea, as we also say, you know, that farming is kind of this, which it does, right? It introduces these virtues and it's a lifestyle and all very important things. But I think we also have to be very concrete about this and saying, yes, but it's modern farming, right? It's farming as a consequence of the agricultural revolution. And just one quick point, I think that people tend to forget this. What would be the consequences if we would turn our backs on the Dutch farmers, on the German farmers, on the New Zealand farmers? Well, all these very rich countries then would have to buy a significant part of their food on the global markets. But who then can no longer afford to buy food? All the poor countries. So right. This is not just about how we would like to eat and about having potential food shortages in Europe, which I don't think we would have, because we are still, for now, rich enough then to just buy on the global market. But if you live in Pakistan, if you live in Egypt, where the population has to use a significant percentage of their income, we're talking about 30 to 40% of their income, they need to buy food. Like, if prices there change by 10, 15, 20%, people will not be able to afford this. So this is not just morally wrong. This could also be the beginning of a humanitarian catastrophe outside of Europe. So I think there are many things that speak for supporting the farmers, supporting more agricultural output and not less agricultural output.
Oh, I'm so glad that you bring that up, because very often, of course, it's Africa. It is definitely these poorer countries that get slammed first. We see it. We absolutely have seen it during the Russian sanctions, and we're seeing this spill over now. And it all seems, of course, part of this larger Great Reset. It seems like it's all part of a larger unelected body of individuals who are driving these stories. Have we been able to connect that thread between Germany, New Zealand, and the Netherlands? You know, that it's not just the Netherlands and their cabinet and approving $25 billion for this reduction of nitrogen in the Netherlands, but it comes from this larger umbrella group of people who is driving this narrative.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it also happens in Canada. It happens partially in the U.S. The U.S. are a little better off because I think their farmers are better organized. And I mean this in a positive way. The agricultural lobby strikes me as much stronger in the United States than in other parts of the world. But you, of course, are absolutely correct. There is a general top-down approach to make farming, to make the production of food more difficult. And you see it in small issues as well. We talked about this before, right? Kind of that, well, maybe we can switch to, you know, insect-based food. Or another thing that you had, I think there's one city, and I think you reported on this as well, this one city in the Netherlands that now banned all commercials for meat, right? So McDonald's can no longer put up a billboard saying, you know, try our Big Mac or something. So there is something afoot. This is not a conspiracy theory. I mean, you can see it with your own eyes. The question, of course, is what can the people do? Because this is driven largely and very often by an unelected bureaucracy. So even if you vote the government out, this thing is probably going to grind on. So it's very, very difficult to do something about it.
It is so frustrating. And we have, you know, our viewers who say we watch the show, we want to make a change. You know, we want to be part of the solution. We don't want to just be outraged about it. So these farmers, the reason we're doing this story is to try to educate people to get out and vote, to try to push these leaders out who are, you know, creating these problems. What do you think is next for the Dutch farmers specifically? Where do you think they go from here?
Well, as far as I can tell, they will continue to protest. But my message to those who want to support them or who you know, find ways to argue for them, I think the key thing to keep in mind is almost everything over the last decades that was driven by that somewhat anonymous bureaucracy, whether it was interest rate policy, which now leads to high inflation, whether it was migration, which is leading to huge problems, and now it's the same thing with the agriculture, they've not delivered what they promised that they're gonna deliver. Again, whether it's good intended and just badly executed, I think that's a discussion we can have separately. But I think it is absolutely accurate to say we have no reason to trust these people. Like, again, whatever their intentions are, separate this debate for me. But simply, these are people who so far have not made life easier. And even if we look at the numbers, right, if somebody says we have to do this for the environment, we have to do this for climate reasons, if you look at the numbers, agriculture and energy use in Europe has been declining. And what I mean by this is we have gotten more and more and more efficient year on year. So it's just a matter of time until we will get even better at this. It's really the time frame. And that, I think, tells you that it's more an ideological / you know, quasi-religious approach to say, oh, this needs to be done by 2030. This needs to be done by 2035. No, it doesn't. It could also, if it's 2040 or 2050, that's also fine, and the Dutch farmers can do it. The German farmers can do it, but you need to give them the appropriate time. So to be very clear, what I'm trying to say is these farmers, all of them, are absolutely aware of the needs to take care of the environment. They are, for God's sake, farmers. It is very absurd that people who have never had, you know, a shovel in their hand or never had a pitchfork in their hand is telling those who is for generations how they are supposed to treat the environment. They know how to do it and they know what the limits are.
Right. And think about this. This struck me too. You think about the $25 billion that the cabinet put aside for this program to reduce these nitrogen emissions. And that's their $25 billion. Imagine if they had helped the farmers, you know, in using that $25 billion to help modernize some of the agriculture instead of driving them out of business. You know, it just seems ridiculous. They could have used this money in a much, much more helpful way to help these farmers.
Just because you made such a fantastic point, now just let me add on something to this, because this is, once again, not just happening in this particular sector, right? Germany has now announced that they are going to use 200 billion euros, that's about 5% of German GDP, to soften the potential fallout from the energy crisis. I mean, can you imagine how much, whether it's nuclear power or fracking or what else, what you could have done with 200 billion euros? But it's always the same. So they make mistakes because they pursue an ideological agenda. And then they kind of, again, with one hand, you know, they put it in our pocket to finance then the fallout and the blowback from the policies that they have pushed for themselves. And I think agriculture will be the same story, exactly as you said. Give the money to those who know what to do with it, and they will come up with solutions.
That's right. Ralph, continue to stay on this story. We will continue to have you on here covering this. I think it's one of the most important stories of our time. So thank you so much for your research. Thank you for everything that you do on this story. We really appreciate it.
Anytime, Clay. Anytime.
And our thanks to Ralph, always a great thinker on this space and deep, deep research on this. So our thanks to Ralph. We're going to get to your super chats here in just a moment. We got a new subscriber. Thank you so much for subscribing. But first,
would you like to try to pronounce that? Javendra?
Oh, it just disappeared. I'm sorry. I'm not going to be able to do that. Baba Yaga. I got Baba Yaga.
That is probably
correct.
Well,
here you go, Clayton. I can actually put that one, last one up again so you can try it again.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Let's give him another shot since he's so good at pronunciation.
Pronounced, that's pronounced Dodik.
Mm-hmm. Michael Galileo.
Michael Galileo. Michelangelo. Michelangelo. And how about, would you like to pronounce that one?
No.
That's Spock's first name.
Is that real? Or is David punking us?
Oh, that's pretty good.
Did you do that, David?
Yes, clearly.
Okay.
Lavadamon. Lavadamon.
I hate all of you guys. I hate all three
pronounced,
of you.
It's pronounced Gina. All right.
Have I done anything yet? Sorry. What did I do? Sorry.
You just get lumped in with them.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair. That's very fair.
Singing Sound of Music.
I do this all the time to my daughters because I have a son and two daughters. And when the girls act up, I'm always like, come on, you guys, eat your breakfast. And the boy is like, I'm doing it. Like, don't lump me in with them. And he's like, say girls, because it's the girls that are being jerks. Not me.
Yes.
So you just got Miles.
You got Miles.
What happens to him all the time?
Oh, boy. All right. We're going to get to your super chats in just a second. Big Basil wants to know what your OnlyFans account name is.
It's called Pissed Off Mama.
Pissed Off Mama. That's a hot account.
I would think it'd have to have the word librarian in it. Because like with the glasses and like the suit, the outfit yesterday.
Pissed Off Mama. Pissed Off Mama Librarian. That's her.
Yeah, there we go.
All right, let's tell you what's, we're going to get to your super chats in a second, but if you would like to get up to 15 free stocks right now, valued up to $32,000, you can do so by opening a free trading account with our friends at Moomoo. Here's the link on your screen. You have to use that, redacted.inc/Moomoo. And Moomoo is a NASDAQ company with a market value of $6 billion. They have 18 million users, and I am one of them. I've been using them for a number of years now. I love their platform because it's super simple and easy to navigate, and it's colorful, and it's intelligent and it's intuitive, and I just like their app. I use it on the iPhone. You can use it on an Android device, your Mac, your Windows. It doesn't matter. You can download it anywhere. And you can trade stocks. You can trade crypto. The best part is, though, when you open your free account, you'll get free stocks. And then when you make your initial deposit in the account, you'll get entered to get up to those 15 free additional stocks valued up to $32,000. So even if you don't do anything with the account, at least you open it, you have those stocks, the market is kind of crappy right now, that's fine. Just sit on them. Just don't do anything with it and just let them ride. And then they also have great learning tools in there as well. So if you want to learn, you can take their e-courses, learn how to trade, learn about trading commodities, you know, buying commodities, buying you know, stocks in oil companies, whatever it happens to be that you're into, gold, silver, precious metals, like I'm into, anything you want to do, you can do that. And by the way, Moomoo just also opened up in Australia as well. So if you want to go to that account, we have a special link just for Australian listeners. We'll have that in the description below, where you can get 180 days of brokerage-free trading plus some additional free bonus stock information and free stocks. Some bonuses up to $50 as well for our friends at Moomoo. So check them out today by going to redacted.inc/Moomoo. Thank you guys so much for supporting independent journalism and what we do here. And I want to thank you all for subscribing to the channel. We do have a daily newsletter. If you go to redacted.inc, you can become a channel member. You can become a supporter of our locals community, which helps support what we do here. And for the price of a cup of coffee once a month, you can support what we do. We have a goal by my birthday. Now, my birthday is December 31st. Yes, I'm a New Year's baby. And our goal is to have 3,000 redacted rebels joining our private community on locals. And so I think we're halfway there on our goal right now. So our goal to get to...
Yeah, we have 25,000 members, but the goal is to have 3,000 VIPs, Rebel VIPs.
Oh,
and that's
okay.
Paying $5 a month or $50 a year.
So to support what we do here, that enables us to hire team members and to do everything that we do here. So redacted.inc, if you become a Redacted VIP, a Redacted Rebel VIP, you can do that. And that's our goal by the end of the year on my birthday. It'll be a good birthday present for me, for all that we've built here on this show.
Yes, please do that.
So thank you so much. All right, let's get to some super chats. We can get a few super chats in before we have to duck out of here.
All right. Damn it, YouTube. YouTube still won't show them to me, so I got to go over here to this other place. See, Darren Daly, Western Europe can pound sand. We spent billions the last 50 years to protect them from a leftist authoritarian Russia. After all was all said and done, they are now more hard left than Moscow.
Yeah, isn't that strange? It really is. And now Moscow is releasing. We showed you the videos last night. A lot of people love that video that Russia released. Like basically mocking like the woke sort of fascist left that's taken over. It's crazy.
Right. I saw a birthday chat from Tish M that said happy birthday to me. And I wanted to say, yes, happy birthday to you, Tish M, and also to my sister. My younger sister, Lindsay. It is also her birthday, October 11th.
Happy birthday to my sister-in-law.
Yeah.
D said, I feel sorry for Clayton after this show.
Don't feel sorry for me. Like I said, I can handle it. And by the way, I didn't build a doghouse. I'm not sleeping in a doghouse. I'm sleeping in my own bed.
Who would sleep in a doghouse when they have a spire though?
Deal with it.
Yeah. You know, he's lucky that it was handled on the show though, because otherwise the passive aggressive, you know,
wife would come out
and then we'd have to deal with it later. It's been dealt with.
It's like okay. Mr. Mom. You want to get into it?
All right. Let's get into it. The kids are a mess, Jack. The house is a mess, Jack.
It's a comfortable shirt.
You want to get nuts? Let's get nuts. Also Michael Keaton.
I was going to say, you're mixing your Michael Keaton references.
I know. I'm sticking with the character, with the guy though. So, Anik Napoba. The WEF seems like modern day Bolshevism. It took Russians 71 years to reject the concept. How long for the Western world to push back against WEF?
Well, we're seeing it now. You're seeing protests all through Germany today. You're seeing protests in Prague today over the weekend or last week. You saw protests in France over the weekend. Mm-hmm. So they are saying down with it. I mean, again, so hopefully it doesn't take them 70 years, but maybe much more quickly.
Yeah, a lot can happen in 70 years.
Okay, and that's all I can get.
Hero says, Redacted Rebels, we need a flag to fly behind our trucks. Yeah, we just need a big white flag with the black stripe and the big R. That's what we need.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes. Or you could do it. You could do it like the Jolly Roger, and you could actually just have it, a black flag with the R on it, and just fly it like the Jolly Roger.
Yes, I like that too.
We could.
Yeah, I kind of like that idea better.
Is the peace symbol available? We could use that because that is a new sign of the resistance.
Yeah, I think the sad part is like the peace symbol has been like co-opted by the left too. It's like how many of these symbols have they decided to co-opt?
You know, I was reading something somewhere that said that the plastics industry actually came up with the recycling symbol. I have to go down that rabbit hole a little bit, but like can't even.
You know what's funny is when you said that, Natalie. I totally heard we should use the P symbol. And I was like, there's a symbol for pee, for peeing, urinating.
No.
That's what I thought you were saying.
Not that.
But no, you said peace symbol, peace symbol.
Yeah.
No.
Someone real quick was asking about lockdowns likely occurring in Australia. Where have you seen that information indicating that? So it's a great question. I don't have it. I have it in a file on my other computer, but specifically there was a group in Australia. It's an offshoot of the World Economic, or I think the World Economic Forum, the World Health Organization, that put this study together, basically talking about the need for environmental lockdowns. And by the way, I mean, Australia was ground zero for what they tried to pull here. I mean, you know, Australia was like the testbed Petri dish for these lockdowns and what they hope to accomplish. So it's not surprising that this would be the place where we would see lockdowns for environmental protection of the whatever, whatever they plan to do to keep us down. So get them and get people inside the house, not using cars, not taking flights, all of that, not eating meat. Like, that's the goal. All right, everyone, we're back here tomorrow live at 4 p.m. Eastern time. Please turn on that little bell notification. So when you subscribe to the channel, there's a little area with your mouse you have to hover over if you're on desktop computer, and you have to click the little bell, unless they've changed that, right? I know they change these things every so often.
Yeah, no, it's the same.
It's the same. And if you're on a mobile device, the same thing, right? Do you know how to get the little bell to work on the...
Well, in the mobile device, they put it in a weird spot. You have to go like into your settings, and then there's like one little thing that's like a toggle. You have to toggle on, get all notifications. It's weird. Like, I would have to walk people through it, and they'd be like, I don't understand. Like, it's stupid.
It's crazy. They bury that stuff now. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us on Redacted on this Tuesday. Really, really appreciate it. And we will see you back here tomorrow for another show.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. And if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Bye-bye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ Mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to iqbar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's iqbar.com, promo code KELLER20.